Professor Tony Ward's work is keeping people out of prison. He's just been awarded the 2021 Royal Society's Mason Jury Medal for influential research into reducing reoffending in violent individuals. He's Professor of Forensic Clinical Psychology at Victoria University's with me now. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Kim.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, it's the Good Lives treatment model that you are best known for. Could you explain to me how that works?
Okay. Well, one of the basic assumptions about the Good Lives model is that every human being, no matter what they've done, comes into the world with, a number of natural desires for certain experiences and outcomes, and they vary. There's quite a few of them. So things like relationships, intimacy, mastery, play, and so on. And the idea is that we find ways to meet these, we set goals based on these primary desires. And sometimes the way, the kind of way we go about pursuing them can be deeply problematic and create, on some occasions, crime, but importantly, generalized problems throughout a person's life. For example, seeking intimacy with a child, a sense of agency and personal power through violence against your partner, and so on.
And
so the idea is that
you address. You accept the primary desire, and you try to redirect it into something more constructive or less damaging.
Exactly right. And a good example of this is an example I got from one of my Belgian colleagues, and we'll call this guy Eric. He kept stealing bikes, and it was frustrating. It was a relatively minor crime, but he kept stealing bikes, and no matter what happened, he kept doing it. And so he's looking at jail time. So one of my colleagues took a Good Lives approach and asked a fundamental question: what is he trying to achieve through this behaviour?
Getting a bike, I imagine.
No. As it turns out, that was not the case. He only chose bikes that were broken down, and he fixed them. So this is a guy who had some sort of mild kind of degree of intellectual impairment and a few other learning challenges. So he chose bikes to repair them, but no one had asked that question. So once they kind of figured out that was what was going on, and if you want to think about the goals or goods or needs that were being met by that, it was to do with mastery and creativity. So they arranged for him to get bikes from the dump, and he was very happy. He started repairing them. He developed a business, and he no longer stole bikes. So what would have happened under a traditional approach to rehabilitation or criminal justice? He simply would have been ultimately put in jail. They would have seen this as risky behaviour, and they wouldn't have asked a very simple question: what is this about?
Right. What about violent individuals, however? Because there's no nuance in that, is there? I mean, they're not trying to fix anything or appease some kind of better angel of their natures. They just are violent.
I think that's not quite true.
I knew you'd say that.
the problem with the way we categorise crimes, they're obviously based on behaviour, typically behaviour. Violent behaviour. But if we look at people, for example, who are violent towards their partners or are violent towards children, what you tend to find is there are a multitude of goals going on that vary enormously. So for some people, violence is a reaction. It's about control, so it's very instrumental. Sometimes it's about feeling incredibly jealous and insecure. Sometimes it's about signalling how a person should behave. Sometimes, in unusual cases, it's pleasurable and there's a sadistic element. Sometimes it's part of affiliation or group approach. This is the way my partner should behave. And I'm embarrassed because my friends think that he or she, don't want to gender this, is not behaving the way they should. So you take a behavior like violence, enormous heterogeneity. Same thing with sexual offending. You take 100 sexual offenders, and what you're going to find is numerous kind of goals that underlie that, or what I call primary goods, Another way to think about that is that they're kind of goals or value states that people are trying to achieve.
It's interesting because your previous work on rehabilitation and sex offenders, you were the inaugural director of the Kia Marama unit at Rolleston Prison in Christchurch, 1989. And people don't tend to accept that there is nuance about sex offenders or paedophiles. They're just all bad and they need to be locked up and the key needs to be thrown away. Just tell me how successful your rehab was.
Well, looking at basic risk-orientated approaches. So the standard approaches to sexual offending when I was at Kia Te Marama was essentially you look at a person's offending, you do a really kind of fine-grained analysis, you pick out the risk factors, you deal with the problems like impulsivity or lack of emotional control or whatever. You have a relapse prevention plan, which is essentially a plan from stopping people from doing this stuff again based on analysis that they're high risk factors and so on. And so that's kind of a pretty typical risk-orientated approach, which is still the dominant approach for correctional treatment around the world. The trouble with that, it's all about what people shouldn't do. It's all about how they shouldn't live. And it's very difficult to motivate people in this process of change when you're only really inviting them not to harm other people. And if you say to someone, look, looking at your offending behavior, the sense I'm getting that you're looking for a sense of personal power or you're looking for intimacy. The way you've gone about that is to sexually abuse the child or assault your partner, which is utterly unacceptable. It's illegal. It's created enormous harm. It's got you in prison. What we're going to do is find another way to achieve these things that you really value, like intimacy or a sense of connectedness. We're going to help you do that. And this is how we're going to do that. So it's an invitation to change. And the reason I think we need to think carefully about our current approaches to rehabilitation is that, first of all, yes, treatment is effective to some degree, just thinking about sexual offending, but it's a small effect size, 5 to 10% reduction. And that's in our best study. So there's a lot to do. And thinking more broadly, we know that in New Zealand, for example, based on 2017 figures, for people who have been in prison, 60% will return within 2 years. So, you know, and we're not doing that well. And my hunch is one of the problems is that our treatment programs are very coarse-grained. They're based on overlapping, overly broad categories like violent behavior or sexual offending. And it does not get, as you said, the nuances, the individual motivations that are linked to people. And also doesn't kind of take into account people are seeking to live the best life they can, a fulfilling life, a meaningful life, even if from our point of view, it looks like an utterly destructive and meaningless life, one of bereft of purpose. And that's not the way it is for the people on the inside. And I learned that when I started working with people who commit sexual offences, that I saw, for example, that they varied enormously. I also saw that for each person, there was a story behind their crime. There was a sense of why they were doing it and what they were trying to achieve. They weren't doing it well. They were doing things in a very destructive way, but also in ways that were counterproductive. They ended up being deeply unhappy or socially isolated. And in my experience, very few people that I met in prison, and I've done quite a bit of work since then, have what you might call psychopathic traits. They're not people who don't care. They're not people who enjoy inflicting pain. They're not antisocial. They've gone about living their lives in ways that are unethical and problematic.
When you talk to people about this, what's the usual response from lay people? Because, I can hear people saying, for heaven's sake, you know, it's not like these people are misguided. They are violent and destructive.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. I've written quite a bit on the relationship between punishment and treatment. And my view is that these are quite different domains. I have no problem holding people accountable. Of course, we should. You'd be crazy not to. It's the right thing to do. So people who commit serious crimes, I believe, deserve to be punished. But alongside that, and we're thinking ahead, how are we going to minimize the chances of them returning to jail and on the way to doing that, hurting and harming others? So why not adopt an approach that takes their particular interests seriously and helps them to build the skills, the opportunities to achieve these things? So thinking about Eric, a bicycle example is a very minor example. And why not do that? So you can think about it purely pragmatically. What's the best way to engage people in the process of change? And I don't think it's saying to them, look, I want you to spend 9 months essentially talking about your deepest fears, exploring your sexual fantasies, and doing all this very difficult work. And at the end of that, what I can promise you're less likely to hurt other people. It's not much of an invitation to change. So even if you're pragmatic about it, and I think that's an important consideration, this sort of approach, I think, makes more sense.
As you said, our reconviction rate for those released from prison is 60% within 2 years. How does that compare with other countries?
It's pretty similar. Looking at Australia, for example, I think it's around about 40%. Within 51%, sorry, within 2 years. Canada, 40 to 50%. Also, prison's expensive. A recent study in Australia, $300 a day to keep people in prison. So it's expensive, and the reconviction rates are high. And one of my, well, I've got a number of opinions on this, as you might imagine. I've been doing this
I
work for
imagine.
30 years. And I think part of the problem, there's a lot of problems. Part of them, I think the othering, issue that you brought up with your last speaker, that it's very easy to see people who commit offences as moral strangers, as people not like us
Yeah,
who
interesting.
somehow are deviant. Yeah.
And
And I don't think
so
that's the
it
case.
makes us feel better if we just put them in a special corral for bad
Yeah.
people. Giving them
Yeah.
something to aim for then, and something to lose, is that
Yes.
part of the idea?
That's right. So, obviously, to give an example of perhaps a typical kind of program, you might have an individual who really wants to be a carpenter. And there's something he's never developed. He's got some skills. He's in a prison like Kia Marama or Te Pariti, which is sexual offending prisons or units, sorry. They've got great resources. And okay, they're going to help this guy become a carpenter. And along the way, so he really wants to do this, but obviously this is a dangerous man, drug and alcohol problems. You're not going to sit him in a workshop with all these tools, these very sharp tools, saws and chisels, because the chances are he's going to hurt someone. So in order to even get entry to this workshop, he needs to work on his emotional, his anger problems. Some of them learn to communicate a little bit more effectively so he can talk to his tutors. And as he develops these skills, he then gets entry and he gets over in a graduated way, he gets given increased opportunities to learn more complex things, to have more and more agency, if you like. And along the way, he's learning to work on his risk factors. He's dealing with his levels of impulsivity. He's learning to plan more effectively. He's learning to manage his anger. He's realizing that if, look, if I get drunk, I'm out of this program. So being on doing something that matters to him and helping him to achieve this in a kind of a goal graded way is deeply reinforcing, and the possibility of losing that is punishing. So of course he's going to work harder in doing things that he or she wouldn't normally do. For example, face up to their addiction issues, because he can see the benefits of not being drunk, if you like, being fully in control of his behavior when he's working with a very expensive piece of wood, and he's trying to develop an intricate design.
You obviously think that nobody is beyond salvation or repair, whichever word you choose. Do you?
I'm very of course I see people who it's very, very difficult for their lives to turn around because they've got many, many years of problematic behavior, reinforcement of violence, environments that promote it, very difficult to do. And in those sort of cases, what you need is a lot more environmental control. But for many people, and so there might always be some degree of supervision. So people who are long histories of violence in and out of prison, they may need some kind of ongoing maintenance. But in my experience, most people don't require that. They actually are capable with supports and resources of achieving things. And I think that kind of strikes me is surely we're all like this. We all have our dreams and goals, our values, things we want to do, and we rely on others' supports to do that. We rely on our partners, we rely on our jobs, we rely on access to movies, sports events, and so on. So we're all creatures of relationships. We're all ecologically embedded. We need these things. So it's just that the question is with the people who are in prison, we also have to keep a very close eye on reducing and managing risks. So for the Good Lives approach, there are two key goals that are intertwined: helping someone attain a more fulfilling life, a meaningful life, if you like. Alongside that, making sure you reduce and manage risk. You have to have both.
Right.
If you only have one, you've got a very dangerous, happy person.
Yeah.
If you've
A
only got the
dangerous,
other,
happy
you've got
person.
it's
Right.
not good.
No.
And if you've got the other, you've got a person who's utterly disconnected.
So it seems as if your work is more taken up overseas than it is in New Zealand. Is that true?
Yeah, so as part of this, I looked at where it's being used around the world. It's Belgium, France, Ireland, Scotland, England, Germany, Finland, Australia, Namibia, Canada, Korea, US, Czech Republic, all sorts of places. And I think up until recently, I've been pretty much ignored in New Zealand. And I think the main reason is that the Department of Corrections have been very much wedded or I don't want to put that in a pejorative way because that's their right. They're kind of invested in a risk reduction approach, what's called the risk need responsivity model, and managing risk factors.
Right.
But having said that, in recent years, for the first time, I've been asked to give workshops to the Department of Corrections psychologists. I'm giving a workshop with them in Auckland to the psychiatric forensic unit. So the last 2 years, my colleague Mary Bonneo and I have done about three, and Gwenda Willis in Auckland, have done about three workshops in New Zealand, and there's increased demand for more. And I think the reason is that clinicians like this approach because it's more therapeutic. It treats the person who commits the offence as one of us, in the sense that we can understand their behaviour and we can work with them rather than as someone we need to quarantine and manage in some way, rather than simply as a bearer of risk. And the way I often phrase, I use the metaphor of a pin cushion. Typical approaches that see an individual as a pin cushion filled with pins, and each pin is a risk factor. So treatment focuses on taking out these pins, and you think treatment's effective, fantastic. But what are you left with? You're left with a pincushion full of holes. So, in other words, a life with nowhere to go.
Ah, right. That's a very good analogy. 3 years ago, Andrew Little said he wanted to start a public conversation about ways to reduce reoffending. I mean, we're constantly harping on about how we've got too
Yeah.
many people in prison, we'll be having to build too many prisons and so on. So abolishing three strikes laws, presumably part of that.
Yeah.
Anything else? I mean, do you think that the government's got it?
I liked that initiative. I was actually part of that original advisory group, and then I had to pull out for kind of professional reasons. I had too much going on. But what I noticed about that group, and what I noticed in the conversations I had with people around the country, that this is a morally charged area. Even the membership of the group was quite politicized, and that people had positions. Whereas my view is that, look, we need a plan that's going to appeal to people from all over New Zealand. You know, the mums and dads from Manawarra, Kandala, as well as Porirua East. You know, we need a plan that's going to speak to all New Zealanders. But everyone had the solution, you know, their way of doing things, which typically was excluding other people. And my experience is that it doesn't work. There's no one reason why people commit crimes. It's complex. Let's get real. Let's take theory
But
research
you know
seriously.
that politically, one party is always going to be, I mean, it's a cliche, come election time, there's always going to be the Law and Order Party. And they're going to say, we're going to get tough on crime. We've had enough of gangs. And that's what we're stuck with, that politicisation, aren't we?
We're stuck with it, but I think there's different stories to be told. So I think with the Law and Order group, I would say absolutely understand where you're coming from. Let's make this a safer place. To do that, we've got to engage people in change. And for the people who are committed to equity and equality and giving people a fair chance, I'd say absolutely. Let's look at kind of common human entitlements, human needs, as well as duties and obligations. Let's look at both.
Excellent to talk to you. Thank you. Congratulations once again. And a lot of interest from our listeners in what you've been saying. Thank you, Professor Tony Ward, who has been presented the Royal Society Mason Jury Medal for his original research on treating violent individuals. It's been very influential around the world.